Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. At least 20 people were killed in northern Cameroon Wednesday in two suicide bombings that officials are blaming on the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. The attacks happened simultaneously at a large market and a residential neighborhood in Maroua, which is the capital of Cameroon's far north region. A businessman in the market told VOA that hundreds of people were wounded and taken to hospitals. The governor of the region said authorities are investigating, but voiced strong suspicion that the attack was a work of Boko Haram. United Nations aid agencies report intense fighting in Yemen that continues to take a heavy toll on civilians. Lisa Schlein reports.
The United Nations reports more than 3,600 people have been killed, nearly half civilians, since Saudi Arabia's bombing campaign against Houthi rebels began March 26th. It says another 17,300 people have been wounded, including 4,000 civilians. The UN Human Rights Office says deaths and injuries have occurred after a so-called humanitarian pause was supposed to have taken effect on July 11th. Instead of a hoped-for ceasefire, agency spokesman Rupert Colville says airstrikes, ground clashes, shelling, sniper attacks, and improvised explosive devices have continued relentlessly throughout the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Votes are being counted in Burundi, where pre-election violence has caused thousands of people to leave the country in the past few months. Official vote results are expected on Thursday. The controversial presidential election Tuesday is believed to have had a low turnout. This is VOA News. An international rights group has accused South Sudanese government forces and allied fighters of civilian killings, rapes, and destruction of property during a military operation in Unity State. Human Rights Watch said in a statement Wednesday that the alleged attacks on civilians between April and June of 2015 amount to war crimes, and the killings and rapes may also constitute crimes against humanity. In a report issued Wednesday, Human Rights Watch detailed the findings of more than 170 interviews in May and June with survivors of the attacks. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is visiting Saudi Arabia Wednesday. It's part of a regional tour aimed at convincing skeptical allies about the benefits of the Iran nuclear deal. Saudi officials, however, have neither publicly condemned nor endorsed the Iran nuclear agreement announced on July 14th. Carter is to hold meetings with King Salman as well as the Saudi Minister of Defense before heading back to Jordan. Pakistan's Supreme Court has agreed to hear an appeal in the case of a Christian woman facing the death penalty for blaspheming Islam. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad.
Court officials say the Supreme Court Wednesday suspended the execution of 50-year-old Asia Bibi until it renders a decision on her appeal of her death sentence. A lower court convicted Bibi of blasphemy in 2010 and sentenced her to death for comments she made about Islam during an argument with co-workers over drinking water. Blasphemy is a very serious charge in Pakistan that can cost you your life in other ways. Even unproven allegations can spark mob violence, and acquittals are rare. Bibi's lawyer, Saiful Malook, says despite a weak legal case against her, the lower court succumbed to pressure. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Police in northern Afghanistan say a suicide bomber detonated a vehicle packed with explosives in a crowded marketplace, killing 19 people and wounding more than 35 others. The deputy police provincial police chief told reporters that the attack in Almar district of the Faryab province was apparently aimed at military personnel. However, no one has yet claimed responsibility for that violence. U.S. President Barack Obama will meet with a group of 10 business owners at the White House on Wednesday as he pushes Congress to reauthorize a charter for a government agency that assists American companies who sell their goods in foreign markets. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras met with bankers Wednesday as lawmakers began another emergency debate on a second package of judicial and banking reforms needed to secure crucial bailout funds from Europe. Greek banks reopened on Monday for the first time in 3 weeks, but capital controls remain in place. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Swohib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
A former Burundian leader is calling for the international community not to recognize the result of the country's presidential election. Opposition parties boycotted Tuesday's poll because President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for re-election, defying opponents who say he's not eligible to serve a third term.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Bujumbura. Details next. Also in the news, an international rights group has accused South Sudanese government forces and allied fighters of civilian killings, rapes and destruction of property. And Hungary estimates the numbers of Syrian and African migrants entering the country in 2015 could reach 300,000. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Tanzania, and in our feature segment, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry discusses the new nuclear deal with Iran on VOA. Stay tuned. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a former Burundi leader is calling for the international community not to recognize the result of the country's presidential election. Opposition parties boycotted yesterday's poll because President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for re-election, defying opponents who say he is not eligible to serve a third term. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Bujumbura.
Vote counting is underway from Tuesday's election in Burundi, and President Pierre Nkurunziza is certain to win after running unopposed. In an interview with VOA, former Burundi President Domitien Ndayizeye says opposition parties will not recognize the election results, and neither should anyone else.
There is not enough participation of the other political parties. That is why we say and we ask to the international community not to recognize these elections and to go on pushing pressure on the current government and the ruling party so that we agree to organize free and fair elections which will be credible and which will bring peace and security for all.
Since the president announced he will seek a third term, Burundi has experienced 3 months of street protest, a failed coup attempt, and the departure of more than 170,000 people to nearby countries fleeing the unrest. Former President Ndayizeye says the government did not help matters by ignoring the protest and using intimidation against opponents.
If the current government accept to go, they use forces, they use Imbonerakure to put pressure on the people. And the third and the main problem is they have decided the current president, Pierre Nkurunziza, as candidate for his third mandate.
Critics of Mr. Nkurunziza say he is violating the two-term limit in Burundi's constitution, but the constitutional court ruled he's eligible for a third term because he was chosen by lawmakers and not voters for his first term in 2005. The United States said Tuesday that by going ahead with the election, Burundi's government risked losing legitimacy in the eyes of its people and could unravel the Arusha Agreement that ended the country's civil war. The UN advisers monitored Tuesday's vote, which included 3.8 million eligible voters. Turnout was light in Bujumbura, held down by gunfire and explosions the night before that left at least 2 people dead in the city. Official election results are expected to be announced later this week. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
An international rights group has accused South Sudanese government forces and allied fighters of civilian killings, rapes, and destruction of property during a military operation in Unity State. Human Rights Watch said in a statement today that the alleged attacks on civilians between April and June of 2015 amount to war crimes, and the killings and rapes may also constitute crimes against humanity. In a report issued today, Human Rights Watch details the findings of more than 117 interviews in May and June with survivors of the attacks. attacks. It says more than 125 of the interviewees were displaced by the fighting or attacks on their villages. The rights group says it has documented about 60 unlawful killings of men, women, and children, including the elderly. It says some victims were hanged, others shot, and others burned alive. Daniel Bakala, Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, called the attacks a devastating offensive characterized by shocking disregard for civilian life. The report says fighters from the Bul Nuer ethnic group operated alongside government fighters, shooting at civilians as they fled into forests and swamps. It also says the government forces and allied militia deliberately burned villages to the ground and destroyed food stores and seeds intended for cultivation. It says the rights groups documented 63 cases of rape, including gang rapes, yet only one woman reported getting medical or other services for sexual violence. It says government soldiers and Bul Nuer fighters also beat women, threatened them with death, and abducted them. Human Rights Watch is calling on the United Nations Security Council to expand targeted sanctions on commanders and other responsible for the events of the Unity State Offensive and to set up a court made up of South Sudanese and international legal officials to investigate and prosecute the worst crimes. It is calling on U.S. President Barack Obama to make a public commitment to advance an arms embargo when he visits the African Union next week, and it calls on the African Union, regional governments, and key partners of South Sudan to support those steps. Hungary estimates the numbers of Syrian and African migrants entering the country could triple its population of asylum seekers this year. A spokesman for the prime minister says they anticipate 300,000 migrants in 2015. More than 90,000 have already arrived, though most continue to other countries. Jan Lazar says they are rushing to complete construction of a 10-foot-tall fence to slow the arrival of migrants along a 100-mile border with Serbia. In Calais, France, operators of the Eurotunnel beneath the English Channel predict more disruptions in service between France and England. They say more than 3,000 migrants have pitched makeshift shelters around the port of Calais. Efforts to prevent migrants from jumping on lorries bound for England have been made worse by a blockade created by striking French ferry workers. The operators of the Channel Tunnel have asked the French and British governments to reimburse rising security costs. During a conference of mayors at the Vatican, the mayor of New York City in the U.S. said on Tuesday it was not fair that the European Union is leaving Italy to struggle with the greatest migrant burden. Bill de Blasio, who is of Italian descent, noted that on Monday the EU Commission failed to agree on a formula for accepting 40,000 asylum seekers. When U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Nairobi for a global conference on entrepreneurship on Saturday, he'll be greeted by lots of enthusiastic young people ready to make their mark on the world. He will also see a city that has undergone a major facelift. VOA's Vincent Macori spoke with David Arnold in Washington about how proud Kenya is to be the venue for this U.S. conference.
Well, this summit is important. First, we have to say to Kenyans, they feel this is a great honor that this summit is taking place in Kenya, a summit that is sponsored by the United States of America. It will not come back here again anytime soon, because since it started, I think it has happened in just one or two other regions of it. It's a summit that encourages young people to have an entrepreneurial spirit. And Africa today is a continent that has young people who are raring to go as far as in entrepreneurship. They have a lot of initiatives. And you are to Nairobi today. There's an exhibit at the Kenyatta International Conference Center where young people are exhibiting their ideas. It's so critical in a country which has a very high level of unemployment.
What is the expectation of some of these young entrepreneurs who are attending, and where do they come from?
Well, they're coming from different parts of the world, and they get this inspiration from President Obama, who has shown a lot of interest in young people. One of the other things I've had so many of the young people say is that they're hoping this kind of conference, and especially with the nudging of President Obama, more and more people can be willing to direct finances, because that is what is missing, especially in countries like Kenya, where the young people have some ideas, but they may not have money to actualize those ideas. So they're hoping that with this kind of focus on them, there will be people in the private sector who can partner, also even with government entities, to raise the finances they need in order for them to implement the kind of ideas they have, so they can see their wonderful innovations, their ideas that can help countries like Kenya to not only create employment for the young individuals, but also rise up and be seen in the world through innovation.
What does it look like around the center? Is there a lot of security?
There is heightened security in the country. It has been like that for the last few weeks. The country has made sure that there will be security present for everybody up in this town. Also, things have changed. I mean, the city looks clean. Things are cleaned up, organized much better than they were before. There are places where trees have been planted, flowers have been planted, just to give it a kind of a facelift. Many are delighted that there is at least an effort to make the city more more attractive to everybody.
That was Vincent McCorry telling David Arnold about the scene being set for the summit on youth entrepreneurship in Nairobi. Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has told the Associated Press a new multinational force in the West Africa region will defeat the Boko Haram militants within the next 18 months. Mr. Buhari is in Washington, where he met with the U.S. President and other U.S. officials about his nation's problems with corruption, a six-year conflict with the Islamist extremists, and other issues. Mr. Buhari also says he will consider swapping detained Boko Haram leaders in exchange for the return of more than 250 girls kidnapped from the Chibok school more than a year ago. However, he said he needed guarantees that he was dealing with Boko Haram leadership, whose identities remain uncertain. Meanwhile, the Borno State home of Mr. Buhari's newly appointed army chief was burned to the ground yesterday by attackers who officials believe were members of Boko Haram. Major General T.Y. Buratai was not at home at the time of the attack. And in Washington, the World Bank has announced it has pledged $2.1 billion to rebuild the three northeast states devastated by the Boko Haram insurgency. In related news, at least 20 people were killed in northern Cameroon today in two suicide bombings that officials are blaming on Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. The attacks happened simultaneously at a large market and a residential neighborhood in Marwa, the capital of Cameroon's far northern region. A businessman in the market told VOA that hundreds of people were wounded and taken to hospitals. The Red Cross says its emblem is being falsely used in the violence-plagued northern part of Cameroon, where Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency has spilled over, as well as the troubled eastern border with the Central African Republic. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from Yaounde.
It is a distinctive emblem. The Red Cross, emblazoned against a white background, was the original symbol declared at the 1864 Geneva Convention to mark and protect individuals and objects that provide humanitarian aid in armed conflict zones. It has since become one of several symbols of the National Societies of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. But Nicolas Mbako, Director of Operational Development at the Cameroon Red Cross, says some humanitarian agencies operating in Boko Haram conflict zones in northern Cameroon and its eastern border region are using the emblem without authorization from the Red Cross.
Parmi les abus, les atteintes, il y a l'imitation, il y a l'usurpation.
He says among the misuses is imitation, usurpation and perfidy, which is using an emblem in times of war to deceive an enemy. He says the danger that arises from such illegal use is the reduction of the protective value of the emblem and thus putting in peril all humanitarian assistance. According to regulations governing the Red Cross societies, the Red Cross emblem is meant to show that persons or objects are linked to the movement. For those not associated with the movement, the regulations stipulate that a distinction authorized by the Red Cross must be made to indicate persons or objects not linked to the societies. Cameroon says its eastern border is home to about 200,000 Central African refugees, and northern Cameroon hosts close to 80,000 people fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency and 100,000 internally displaced persons. Relief agencies and humanitarian groups deploy in the area to help. Emerentia Musa of Cameroon Self-Reliance, a relief agency helping the refugees, says they pose as Red Cross volunteers to avoid a possible attack from insurgents or Cameroonian soldiers who might mistake them for attackers.
Nobody has ever told us not to use the Red Cross signal. And when we use it, nobody disturbs us. We put it in our cars, we put it in our office, and nobody disturbs us.
Mirai Titi of Cameroon Red Cross says the illegal use may lead to a distrust of the emblem.
Ça revient à dire que sur un terrain conflictuel, nos volontaires peuvent être pris.
She says if the abusive use continues, their volunteers may be targeted in conflict zones by rebels, fighters, and even regular armies when they will lose confidence and trust of the emblems. Moki, Edwin Kinzuka, for VOA News, Yaoundé.
With the success of antiretroviral drugs in treating HIV/AIDS, many infected people are able to lead more normal lives. But treatment is not a cure. A renewed call for a cure was made by the International AIDS Society Conference on Pathogenesis Prevention and Treatment in Vancouver, Canada. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Nicolas Chaumont focuses much of his research on finding where the AIDS virus hides in the body. The University of Montreal associate microbiology professor says even without a cure, things are much better today than they used to be.
Since the isolation of HIV in 1983, we have better weapons to fight HIV infection, and we have better drugs, more drugs. And if you compare the efficacy of these drugs in the pre-antiretroviral therapy era to now, clearly they show higher potency and reduced toxicity. And more importantly, the number of pills the people living with HIV have to take per day has been considerably reduced. And this is clearly a great scientific success.
He says infected people are living longer and healthier lives.
If you look at the expected survival of a 20-year-old person living with HIV in a high-income country between 1995 and now, you would see this dramatic increase in the number of years people can expect to live with HIV drugs. And this life expectancy is actually quite close to the one you would see in the uninfected populations.
Chaumont asks, with such success, why is a cure needed?
Well, I think there are different answers to that question. So first, antiretroviral therapy do not eradicate the virus. So it greatly reduces the amount of virus in the body, but the virus is still there. And because the virus is still there, other issues either appear or persist.
One of those issues is not a medical one.
The first one is that the criminalization and the stigmatization of people living with HIV still remains in 2015 in most of the countries in the world. People living with HIV face many issues: criminalization, stigmatization, in their family and at work. For that first reason, a cure for HIV is something that we all want to develop.
Next, while ART, or antiretroviral therapy, is a huge success, health officials say millions who need it still cannot get it.
The third reason why we need to do better than ART is that those treatments are actually quite toxic. And as you know, these drugs have to be administered indefinitely for your lifetime. And we know that they may induce some side effects. And more importantly, we don't know what are the long-term effects of these drugs for more than 20 years. So if you need a fourth reason for why we need a cure, I'm going to give you one more. And this is money.
Chaumont uses Canada as an example, saying HIV generates enormous costs in terms of human suffering, job loss, and the financial burden on the healthcare system. And people who interrupt their drug treatment for whatever reason see HIV make a strong comeback. A cure, he says, would eliminate these problems. But a cure means finding where HIV hides and eliminating it. It's known that reservoirs can be found in the brain, lymph nodes, the gut, and genital tract. Some reservoirs are active, while others are latent or silent, waiting for the opportunity to become active. They can also hide at the cellular level, especially in what are called memory cells. These white blood cells are part of the immune system. They either directly attack bacteria or viruses or release antibodies. He says the three main barriers to a cure are HIV persistent tissues, latent reservoirs of infected cells that are indistinguishable from uninfected cells, and diverse types of latent reservoirs.
There are two main types of cure that have been proposed. The first one is the sterilizing cure. This is the ideal model in which you would eradicate all trace of virus from the body. The second type of cure, which is probably more realistic, is what we call a functional cure. And in that case, you would probably try to also reduce the size of the reservoir significantly and then boost the immune system so it can control some events of reactivation from the latent reservoir.
Professor Chaumont says when antiretroviral therapy is administered soon after infection, it can dramatically reduce reservoirs of infected cells. But for the majority of infected people who do not receive the drugs early, new ART strategies are being developed. One is called the shock and kill approach. This would, in a sense, wake up dormant or latent HIV and cause it to attack cells. But in doing so, it becomes susceptible to antiretroviral drugs. At the same time, the strategy must also include a way to boost the immune system so it too can attack the virus. Until a cure is found, ART remains the main weapon against HIV, with new studies showing the earlier it's given, the better. Research also continues on an HIV vaccine. Neither a cure nor a vaccine is expected soon. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama prepares to travel to Kenya, his father's homeland, for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit and to Ethiopia to meet with African Union officials. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of his trip to the continent. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight. I'm the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A former Burundi leader is calling for the international community not to recognize the results of the country's presidential election. An international rights group has accused South Sudanese government forces and allied fighters of civilian killings, rapes, and destruction of property. And Hungary estimates the numbers of Syrian and African migrants entering the country in 2015 could reach 300,000. Coming up, music from Tanzania. And in our feature segment, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry discusses the new nuclear deal with Iran with VOA. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sonny, I understand a big tennis star has traveled to Africa.
Yehias, Swiss tennis star Roger Federer says his first visit to Malawi this week was an unforgettable journey and learning experience. The world's number two ranked player traveled to Southern Africa after losing to Novak Djokovic in the Wimbledon final July 12th. In Malawi, Federer visited the Mbwetu Community-Based Child Care Center. He says his foundation has helped support the preschool for more than 4 years, as well as others in the Southern Africa region.
I am so happy and emotional that I can see a preschool of this quality here in Malawi. I must say it's quite extraordinary, actually, and it makes me really, really happy. And that's not possible with the help of the community, the parents, Action Aid Malawi, everybody involved. It's been amazing, and it's been an absolute pleasure to be here today.
Roger Federer established his foundation in 2003 to help poor children in Africa and provide them with an education. 5 years ago, he played Spanish star Rafael Nadal in a charity exhibition called Match for Africa that raised more than $4 million for his foundation and Rafa's foundation. In Malawi, Federer played with the children and helped cook and serve them lunch. He says he liked what he saw at the child care center.
Really impressed at the community here because it's the driver and they are so committed to improving their own village, helping their kids for a better future and making it sustainable at the end of the day. That's most important, that this is an ongoing thing and hopefully forever.
Roger Federer has ambitious goals for his foundation, and he reflects on his trip to Malawi.
I learned a lot, and I thought it was an unforgettable journey of learning for me personally as well. I feel like the kids are having a great time. It's so inspiring and motivating every time I come to a beautiful country like Malawi this time. It's my first time here. And of course, I'll keep going. We have high goals for the Roger Federer Foundation to reach 1 million children that can benefit from the foundation because children are tomorrow's future.
Roger Federer and his wife, Mirka, herself a former professional tennis player, have 4 children of their own. Mirka gave birth to twin girls in 2009, and last year she gave birth to twin boys. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening with the recent results in men's 2016 Olympic qualifying matches played across the continent.
In Port Harcourt, it was Nigeria 2, Congo Brazzaville 1. In Blida, Algeria 2, Sierra Leone 0. In Libreville, Gabon 0, Mali 1. In Abidjan, Ivory Coast 0, Zambia 0. Alexandria, Egypt 4, Uganda 0. In Harare, Zimbabwe 1, South Africa 1. And in Rabat, Morocco 1, Tunisia 0. Now, a lot of focus, Sonny, at the weekend was on that Nigeria-Congo game, not least because of the Congo coach, 67-year-old Claude Leroy. He's a celebrated coach. He's worked in Africa with a number of countries. He's had first, second, third, and fourth place finishes at the Africa Cup of Nations. And that first place finish came way back in 1988 with Cameroon. He's also, with Cameroon, gone to the World Cup. That was the 1998 finals in France. So as far as World Cup and Cup of Nations go, he's ticked most of the boxes. But the one thing he hasn't done is get to the Olympic Games football tournament, and he's hoping to do it this time with the junior Congolese Red Devils. Now, at one stage in Port Harcourt, and incidentally, congratulations to the people of Southeast Nigeria. It was a 40,000-capacity stadium, and I didn't see many spare seats. In the first half, Sonny, Nigeria were dominant, but they just could not finish. Some really wild shooting and some brave defending, too, from the Congolese. And the Congolese goalkeeper, Christopher Mafumbi, now he played in the Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea this year, and he was outstanding. Ajayi, who had missed a couple of sitters from Nigeria in the first half, he really took charge early in the second half, scoring twice within 7 minutes. At that stage, Sonny, 2-0 to Nigeria, and I would have put a few dollars on with the local bookmaker that it was going to finish about 4-0 or 5-0 to the Nigerians. They were overwhelming the Congolese. But a couple of bad decisions against Nigerians. First of all, a blatant handball in the penalty area by a Congolese defender went unnoticed by the Kenyan referee. And then the Kenyan referee, to me, really blundered. He awarded a yellow card to a Congolese player when he should definitely have given him a red. It was a foot-up tackle. It went flying into the midriff of a Nigerian player. And if I've ever seen a red card in my life, that was one. But the Congolese escaped with a yellow. And midway through the second half, a parry by the Nigerian goalkeeper was hammered into the net by Nkunku. So 2-1 to Nigeria, the final score. Flattering for the Congolese, undoubtedly. But the situation now, Sonny, is that if Congo win the return match in Pointe Noire at the beginning of August 1-0, they will qualify on the away goals rule. Algeria had a comfortable victory over Sierra Leone, 2-0, and the Sierra Leone team are at a huge disadvantage, Sonny, because of the Ebola epidemic, which is still smoldering in West Africa and has claimed over 11,000 lives. The return match will also be played in Algeria. So you've got to say advantage Algeria as far as that tie is concerned. A surprise in Libreville, Gabon, the surprise winners in 2011 of the first CAF Under-23 Championship, they lost 1-0 at home to Mali, a goal by Niani after 77 minutes. In a sense, Sonny, this was justice for the Malians because they had been eliminated by the Gabonese in the previous Olympic Games qualifiers. No goals in Abidjan, a bit of a surprise that really for the Ivorians. You would have expected them to win at home against the Zambians. And the Zambians will be particularly pleased because they had to play at least half of the second half, a man short after one of their players was yellow carded a second time and therefore got a red. The most impressive winners were Egypt. And I'm proud to say that on the previous edition of the Sunny Side of Sport, we said, watch out for these baby pharaohs. They are a really strong team. And so it proved, 4-0 against Uganda in Alexandria. The Ugandan coach, Sonny, before the match, Milutin Shredojevic, was very angry at the Egyptian TV commentators who described his team as a punching bag. But unfortunately, as it turned out, that was more or less true because after leading 1-0 at halftime, the Egyptians went on a scoring spree in the second half. And a name to watch out for, Kat Raba, that's his nickname, and it means electricity in Arabic. He scored 2 of the 4 goals, and he's been a consistent scorer for Egypt this year, both in the Olympic Games qualifiers and also in the All-Africa Games qualifiers. In Harare, South Africa were the better team, but had to settle for a 1-1 draw with Zimbabwe, who equalized 7 minutes from the end when Masona converted a penalty. Keegan Dolly, who has played for the South African senior team, he scored after 67 minutes to give the baby Bafana Bafana the lead. And obviously the advantage now should be slightly in favour of South Africa with those return matches coming up at the beginning of August. And in a North African derby in Rabat, Morocco edged Tunisia 1-0. The Moroccans, by all accounts, were well on top, but they had to settle for a penalty goal on the stroke of halftime from Ben Cherki. The return match is sunny. On July the 25th, Algeria will play Sierra Leone. And the other matches will be staged between July the 31st and August the 2nd. And it's on August the 2nd that Congo will host Nigeria. I think there's going to be huge interest in that return game. Can the Congolese add to their list of victims? They knocked out Ghana in the previous round. Or will the Nigerian dream team prevail and keep alive hopes of perhaps another great performance at the Olympics in Rio, remembering that in 1996 in Atlanta, Nigeria took the gold medals, and in 2008 in Beijing, Nigeria took silver medals. So they've got a strong Olympic pedigree, Sonny.
Strong Olympic pedigree indeed, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Joining us now with an update on cycling's greatest event, the Tour de France, is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. Digne-les-Bains, a small city in southeastern France, was the starting point for stage 17 of the Tour de France Wednesday. The first stage of the race to take place in the Alps saw riders brave the towering Col de Alos, which at 2,250 meters is the highest point on the Tour de France this year. And it was one of just many grueling climbs on the day. Despite a rest day on Tuesday, the mountain stage took its toll on participants as five riders pulled out of the race during the leg. Among those who pulled out were the world champion of men's elite road race, Michał Kwiatkowski of Poland, and American TJ Van Garderen, who had been in third place overall before dropping out. Following a steep, winding descent from the Col de Alos, riders had to make one more ascent to the finish line at the Praloop ski resort. German Simon Geschke was first to finish the 161-kilometer course, doing so in 4 hours and 15 minutes. The son of a former Olympic sprinter, Geschke was also named the most aggressive rider of the day. Overall race leader Chris Froome was able to fight off a challenge by second-place rider Nairo Quintana Rojas to keep the lead at over 3 minutes and hold on to the yellow jersey, while South African team MTN Kubeka had a great stage, with three of their riders finishing in the top 15, including Eritrean's Daniel Tekle Haimanot and Merhawi Kudus Gebremedin. The team now finds themselves in second place as we approach the final stages of the race. Stage 18, taking place Thursday, will start in the southern French hamlet of Gap before winding its way through the Alps to the town of Saint-Jean-de-Marion in the Arc River Valley. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Jonah, and kudos to MTN Kubeka. Great showing by the African team in the Tour de France. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahya's Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Debate continues on the new nuclear deal with Iran. The Obama administration is presenting its case to the public and the Republican-controlled Congress. Congress has less than 60 days to decide on the plan. One of the main architects of the agreement is Secretary of State John Kerry. He sat down with Satari Drakashish of VOA's Persian service to discuss the plan and why the Obama administration believes it's needed.
Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for talking to the Voice of America Persian.
Delighted. Thank you.
If I may, I would like to start with the UN Security Council today. There was a vote on the passed a resolution on the Iran nuclear deal. Does this vote mean that Iran has stopped being a pariah state in the eyes of the international community?
Well, what the vote means is that people are hopeful that the transformation is going to take place over the course of the next months and years. They're voting for the agreement. They're voting to support what Iran and six other nations agreed on in Vienna. And I think it's an expression of confidence in that agreement, and it's an expression of hope for the future, for Iran, for the rest of the world. Obviously, that agreement is based on the hope that the nuclear problem will be resolved, that Iran will become a nation in good standing with the rest of the international community. But it's going to be proven not by a vote and not by the words. It's going to be proven by the actions over the course of the next implementation of the agreement.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that there will be some transformation. When the deal was announced last week, inside Iran, people came out to the streets. They poured into the streets. They wanted to show their joy. They were celebrating. Do you think it was too early, considering that the U.S. Congress has to review the deal? And also inside Iran, the Iran's Supreme National Security Council has to approve it, and also the Majlis.
Well, no, I don't think it's ever too early for people to express their feelings and to be heard about how they feel about an agreement. Maybe that will have some impact on other people looking at this, and they'll understand how the people of Iran feel about it. So I hope it's a message that's a positive one, but I wouldn't say it's too early. I hope that Congress will see the possibilities of this and that the Supreme Council will see the possibilities.
You negotiated the deal as an exclusively nuclear issue. You did not get into other issues. Yet Iranians have high expectations from this deal, and they are hoping and they're expecting that their economy will change, their lifestyle will change, their everyday life will change. Are you concerned that those people with such high expectations would be disappointed?
No, I think that if the deal goes through and is fully implemented, the people of Iran are going to see an improved standard of living. They'll see sanctions lifted off of them that have prevented commerce, trade, travel, investment, all these other things. So a lot of good things can happen if this deal is fully implemented.
And what would you say to those who are hoping and who are expecting that this deal would help support the people who are for democratic reforms? It doesn't seem that the gates of the Evin prison are going to be opening anytime soon.
Well, this deal, as we said before, if we had chosen any number of issues between Iran and the world community, or between the United States and Iran, you know, we'd have been negotiating for 10 years and never gotten anywhere. And we didn't have that kind of time because of the nuclear issue and where the progress was. We needed to negotiate exclusively on nuclear. And as it is, that took 4 years. So it was very complicated, very difficult issue. And I think that obviously the United States of America will never stop believing in democracy and in people's rights, human rights, and always stand for that. But this deal needed to get the nuclear issue off the table because we were threatened with the possibility of a nuclear arms race in the entire region. And nobody benefits from that. So we took a priority, we focused on the priority, we eliminated the potential of conflict over the nuclear weapons, providing it is accepted by Congress, accepted by the Majlis, and implemented. If that happens, I think the world will be a safer place.
You mentioned, sir, that it was complicated, and there are many complex steps that need to be implemented. Now, the process is going to be long, and some people inside Iran are concerned that because of this process, the United States is not going to be too hard on Iran as far as human rights issues are concerned, or the issue of the four Americans who are wrongfully imprisoned.
We will never, ever stop, first of all, raising the issue of the Americans who are held, but also standing up for people's rights. That's who we are in our country. But we also have to deal with other issues simultaneously. I mean, unfortunately, in the world of diplomacy and foreign affairs, you don't have the luxury of just focusing on one issue and saying, this is the most important thing, we're not going to do anything else. You can't ignore what's happening in Syria. You can't ignore what's happening in Iraq, or what's happening in Yemen, or what's happening in Egypt, or in the Sinai, or, you know, all of these issues compound themselves. And so we involved in public life and in diplomacy in today's world have a very complicated mosaic that we're trying to put together, bring the pieces together. It's not easy. And in the end, it will be, those issues will be resolved through agreements like the one that we reached with Iran. But we have to fight for it.
Sir, if I may, I want to turn to Congress. You will be on Capitol Hill this week, and you will be facing bipartisan skeptics from Congress.
Okay.
They seem to remain unconvinced. What is your battle plan, sir? And are you going to bring anything new, any new arguments, so you can defend the deal?
Well, I'm going to tell the truth about the deal. There are many people who, frankly, some of them had opposed it before they even read it. I mean, many of them admitted they hadn't read the deal when they started opposing it. Some people just oppose the idea of doing a deal with Iran. But I think when people really look at what is gained here, when they see that this is a possibility of actually doing away with a potential of a nuclear weapon, and of perhaps opening up the possibilities of other good things happening, of a new relationship, I think people will see the benefit of it. And obviously, there's a very powerful group of voices who are opposed to it, who spend a lot of money in opposition to it, and that's been heard. But I believe, I'm glad we have the 60 days. I think it will give time for people to really reflect and see that if you don't let this agreement go forward, you could be choosing conflict and war. That could be the alternative. Because if we don't have this agreement, then I believe the Ayatollah would say, why should I negotiate with these guys? They haven't delivered. They don't do it. Why would our colleagues in the world support the sanctions when they say the sanctions were supposed to be to get an agreement? But they got one and now they walked away. So the whole thing comes apart with great danger to the region.
So you mentioned the Ayatollah. On Saturday, Iran's Supreme Leader Khamenei stressed that we do not negotiate with the U.S. About different global and regional issues. He said that we do not negotiate about bilateral issues. And he even said that the slogan, Death to America, are still going to be heard in the streets of Tehran. Does this mean that the embassy right here on Massachusetts Avenue will remain closed, that there will not be any U.S.-Iran cultural relations, and that none of the businesses from the United States is going to go to Iran anytime soon? So if I may.
Well, we have to, obviously, we have to explore it. I mean, on its face, it would seem that way. I mean, the statement was pretty negative and pretty dramatic, and, you know, I have no reason to believe otherwise. But I'm an optimist in global affairs. I'm somebody who believes that what you hear today, you may not hear in 2 months or 10 months or whatever. I just don't know. And for the moment, that's not what we're focused on. We're focused on the nuclear deal. And we will do what we have to do to push back against other activities if we think they interfere with the security of our friends or with our security. We will do what we need to do.
My last question, sir, is that we talked about high expectations from inside Iran. When do you think, realistically, that this deal is going to start working? And when do people, do you think that they will see real changes in their lives? Is it going
to be... Well, Congress has 60 days. So September 19th, there should, by then, sometime, there should have been a vote. If that has happened, that becomes the day that the deal begins to kick in. And then after that, there are certain things that Iran needs to do, and the IAEA needs to do, and those things have to be resolved, all of them, before the sanctions begin to be relieved. So you're looking at somewhere about 6 months or so. It's hard to say exactly. It depends what happens. But I don't think there would be much felt before that. But I think September will be the critical moment when people begin to learn whether or not this will be, in fact, implemented.
And does this include medicine? Does it include easier travel for Iranians to the United States?
Well, it includes the potential of travel, but what it includes immediately is the lifting of specific sanctions on finance, on banking, on the movement of goods. Foodstuffs will be allowed to be sold from Iran, pistachios, carpets, other foodstuffs. I mean, those things will be able to be sold. So it's opening up some things, but not everything yet. The primary embargo still remains in place.
So the long-term trajectory is positive between the United States and Iran?
The long-term trajectory has the possibility of being positive, providing Congress passes this and providing the Majlis and the National Security Council accepts this and we implement it. If we implement this, then we are on a path to perhaps opening up a set of opportunities. If it is not implemented, we're going to have a lot of problems and perhaps even the possibility of conflict, and I find that very tragic, and I hope that we will succeed in persuading people why this agreement actually prevents conflict, provides for security for the region, and will prevent the acquisition of a nuclear weapon.
Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for accepting to do this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
That was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking with Sitari Drakashish of VOA's Persian service. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An African Union-backed court in Senegal has begun proceedings in the trial of former Chadian leader Hissène Habré, accused of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and torture committed during his eight-year rule from 1982 to 1990. The opening of the case in Dakar is an historic step for African justice, marking the first time that the courts of one country on the continent have prosecuted the former ruler of another for alleged human rights crimes. The trial concludes a 15-year battle by victims and rights campaigners to bring the former strongman to justice in Senegal, where he fled after being toppled in a 1990 coup. Habré is blamed for widespread torture and the killing of up to 40,000 people while leading the Central African nation. The United States commends the government of Senegal and the African Union for bringing the former Chadian president before the Extraordinary African Chambers of Senegal. As a signal of our support for these proceedings, U.S. Ambassador to Senegal James Zumwalt and Ambassador-at-Large for War Crimes Issues Stephen Rapp attended the opening of the trial on July 20th. This trial is an important step toward justice for the victims of atrocities committed under Habré's rule and should serve as yet another warning that, no matter their position, perpetrators of atrocities will be held accountable. The United States supports a fair and impartial trial and is committed to helping end impunity for the worst crimes known to humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama prepares to travel to Kenya, his father's homeland, for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, and to Ethiopia to meet with African Union officials. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of his trip to the continent. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
VOA. Hello, I'm Douglas Simpuga.
Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.